Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, April the 2nd, 2026, the day after April Fool's Day. Did you get fooled yesterday? I gotta say, I didn't see a lot of April foolery actually going around yesterday. A little bit here and there, but mostly I just saw a normal day, which, if you've noticed, I've been doing this, it'll be 18 years in June I'll be doing this show. 18 years. I've never pulled an April Fool's on you guys. I actually thought about it once. I had a pretty cool idea, but darn it, then I decided not to do it. It's just not my thing. Anyway, I got no foolery for you today. I got a really good lineup for you. We're going to hear from a lot of folks today. We're going to hear from a wide range of real-world topics, from what is actually happening on a global stage to practical decisions you can make at home to stay more resilient and self-reliant. We're going to dig into shifts in military posture that a lot of people are ignoring. We're going to do that with Ron Paul, along with smarter ways to build systems on your property that actually produce instead of just keeping you busy. That's going to be Ryan Steva talking about some stuff in that regard. We're also going to get into protecting your personal data with Jesse Markowicz. We're going to talk about improving land with better grazing with Carrie Brown, who usually is talking about plants and stuff, but he's going to start covering some other things with us, including grazing. Nick Ferguson is going to talk to us about nursery crops. What does that mean? What are they for? Chef Ken Daniels is going to talk about boiled meat, except it's not boiled. This question came in. It was actually about something called corned beef, which many of you are familiar with. And he's going to talk about how this method, which is really a simmer method, not a boil method, when done properly, can be one of the most amazing culinary techniques that you'll ever learn. And lastly, I'm going to have an anchor segment today answering a question that I've never really gotten this question before. And I think it maybe will lead to an interesting answer from a standpoint of the perspective of what goes on in the world today. And the short version of the question, I'll read the whole email when we get to it, but is, are there more agents of chaos in the world today? Or is it something else? With that in mind, let's go ahead and hear first from Dr. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini. How about this? Do you know what a FOB is, F-O-B? That is a forward operating base. These are not major military installations, but they're significant installations. These are places where our military, or other countries have them too, are closer to the enemy and doing critical operations for combat, surveillance, and things like that. 13 of them that we own in the Middle East, around Iran, most of them in Kuwait, but in some other places too, have been hit by enough Iranian missiles that they are currently uninhabitable. This is something, I'll save my thoughts on it for after a year from Dr. Paul and Chris, but I went to check something today, and I found this absent, this news. And I'll tell you what it is when we come back.
We're taking a headline from Zero Hedge, and this was rather startling. You have to stop and think, you know, what's going on? What kind of war is this? And this comes from New York Times, so it has to be, if it's sort of making us raise our head, that means it really will be looked at by a lot of people. And the headline is 13 U.S. bases are uninhabitable. Pentagon admits much of Iran war overseen by personnel working remotely. Boy, that's modern, isn't it, when you can work from home? I mean, we learned how to do that during COVID. So, but a military, a closing bases?
Dr. Paul, I'm going to need you to close your ears for a second because I'm going to talk about you.
Uh-oh.
As everyone in the world knows,
I'll be embarrassed.
Dr. Paul doesn't talk about himself, but I'm his employee, so I can do it. Dr. Paul was right. You know, for decade after decade, close all the foreign bases, bring all the troops home. He was attacked for it mercilessly, you know, for being right. You know, they attack us. This is what he said. I remember on the stage, watching it on TV, because we are over there. It's the truth. We we're reading that 13 of our bases are now uninhabitable. Why do we have 13 bases out there surrounding Iran? We don't have anybody surrounding us here. How would we feel as Americans if anybody, Iran, Russia, China, had bases circling our nation? How do you think we would feel about that? I know how I would feel. I wouldn't like it. So they don't belong out there. And now it should have been done voluntarily. Close it. You know, every president, Dr. Paul, has been saying the same thing. Nobody does it. And now they're being destroyed. So now it's being done by force, you know. And it's a shame. I'm sure Dr. Paul didn't want to be right in this way. You know, rather the troops come home alive. The bases sell them off for some money. You know, it was all done wrong. And now the price is being paid.
So when I heard all this, I was like, so... Because they weren't real clear about this. Is this due to direct Iranian military action? Or is this shit like we just haven't taken care of things, or is it a combination? It's direct military action by Iran. I do want to explain some mitigation to it, and then I want to talk about something that is missing from the media here. Now, this looks very much confirmed. Some of the stuff has been directly confirmed by CENTCOM. That means we've said, yes, this happened, okay? But... I looked this up, and there's several major media outlets covering this. It's not a top secret thing. They mentioned Zero Hedge, but it's easy to find news on this if you know to look for it from many credible sources, not just, you know, independent blogs and stuff like that. So that's why I believe that it's completely credible. And again, it's being reported that it's confirmed by CENTCOM, though I didn't like dig deep enough to see if CENTCOM is report or you know what all they're confirming. So, but it looks completely legitimate, and I've seen photographs of some pretty serious damage. But I thought, well, this is kind of a big deal. Let me check Fox News. Not there. Okay, they're the right-wing news. Okay, let's go check kind of the, I would call it the left of center, somewhat moderate liberal news major agency, CNN. They would probably, because they hate Trump, so they'll probably talk about, no, they're talking about like the ballroom construction being paused, and he's a big meanie at the Supreme Court and whatever, okay. Like, he all sucks, and yeah, there's stuff there about the Iranian war, but it's how, it's all Trump's fault that the economy sucks because of the Iranian war. All right, I know what I'll do. Like, they call it MS Now, it used to be MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, Ground Zero. This is like the 90% of what's there is why Trump is wrong and how Trump's screwing stuff up. It's not there either. I didn't dig deep. I'm talking, you know, above the fold type, if you're old enough to remember paper, you know. But the front page, like, and the politics page, nothing. Okay, so my question is, what's the real agenda of these media organizations? Is it, obviously it's not to tell the truth, but you would think that if you were just only trying to carry water for the left, it's a pretty juicy thing to throw at Trump, but it's not there. Why not? Do we have a group of people serving the same masters? Is that what's really going on? I don't know. You make that decision for yourself. But I want to kind of feed my anchor segment so we can kind of bookend these two things. When I get to my segment at the end of the show today where we talk about, are there more agents of chaos? I want you to think about the fact that this type of behavior by the media is exactly why Trump is able to go free-range madman all the time, because nobody believes anything they say anyway, because instead of covering the things that are legitimate, they want to do things like take a single line out of a speech, out of context, and say, you know, he threatened a bloodbath in America, basically saying that people would riot in the streets and kill a bunch of people if he didn't win. Stuff like that. And there's been so much of this nonsense that now it's just, it's not even white noise. It's completely ignored whenever the media says anything, unless the person's already unhinged about it. And does that contribute to what my question is from the person sending me, the term agent of chaos? And if so, who's the actual agent of chaos here? We'll talk about that more in a bit. Right now, we're going to talk about something more useful right on your homestead. Ryan Steva, we're going to talk about black soldier fly larva and worm composting on the homestead? This is a great question and a great topic, and I will turn it over to Ryan now.
Hey, TSP community, Ryan Steva here from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today, I'm going to see if I can blast through two questions and answer them at least reasonably decently. The first is from Will, and he asks, what is the best way to make large-scale worm composting system, and also called vermiculture? I breed and eat sell meat rabbits currently. On the ground, I have about 25 with about 30 more bunnies due in the next month or so, and that comes with shit, a lot of shit. I'm looking to use worms to break down faster than my bioreactor composters, mostly to reduce volume prior to aging the manure. I understand it can add, I can add it directly anywhere, meaning the rabbit poop, and sell it. As to the local market, however, I feel like the worms will add enough value to offset the additional work and cost. Well, Will, I'm actually going to probably disagree with you here. It's kind of a maybe, but unlikely, because as far as offsetting the additional cost, and maybe Jack totally disagrees with me, I'm all for value add, but the complexities of processing that much rabbit manure can be quite high, and the amount you're going to make via the worms may or may not be worth it. So you're going to have to calculate that yourself, but there are a lot of complexities to trying to process this much rabbit manure. One of them being that there is about five or six different types of vermicompost systems, each having their pros and cons, and the ability to separate the different parts and pieces out, like the worms, for sale or for use, can be quite difficult, and it really is a lot of extra work. Also, rabbit manure can't be composted or vermicomposted directly. You're going to have to come up with some mixture of something else. So some other type of essentially a brown. Rabbit manure is going to be too nitrogen rich just by itself. So you're going to have to mix in, let's say, sawdust or something else into it to allow for that to work. And vermicomposting on a large scale can be difficult. So if you're looking for one specific thing, if it's just worms, you can make that easier. Or if it's just the liquid for an extract, that can be easier. But as you try to tease apart those different items that you want, it can be a lot harder and a lot more expensive as you go. That said, if your primary purpose here is worms, the best overall system for that is going to be what's called a stacked tray or migration-based system, because that's going to allow the worms to move up and down with the new product that's being put in, and that's going to make it a lot easier to sort out and find your worms. There are four other systems that I'm going to mention here, and I don't have time to go through and list all the pros and cons of each for your given situation, but I'm going to list the items, and I'm going to send a document to Jack, and hopefully he'll have some way of posting that will have all the pros and cons for you. The first is a static bin system, which is very low cost to operate, but it's also time intensive. The second is a stacked tray system, which I just mentioned, which also sometimes is called a flow-through system. There are also continuous flow reactors, or CFRs, as well as windrows or outdoor beds. And then finally, there's a vermifilter or worm reactor. So those are your primary systems, and if you want to go ahead with something, I would generally recommend the stack tray system for your specific question. But I would just give a little bit of extra consideration that it really may not be worth the extra work to do this, as you have a viable product already and the value add might not be enough to be worth your time. The second question here is from David, who asks, what is an effective pre-made container for raising and collecting black soldier flies? Now, David has a ton of product to go through, which includes intestines of a lot of different animals. He runs an amazing regenerative farm with a lot of different animals that are being processed consistently, and he's concerned that the volume is going to overrun what his more traditional composting systems could actually keep up with. And David also says that he's been trying for a couple of years to put together a black soldier fly larva growing system, and he's just never gotten around to it. So he's wondering if there's any pre-made bins that he can just kind of try to start using. And it sounds like he's wanting to start using them, and then after that, determine if he likes the systems or not, so he can build more or expand on that, but just get his hands dirty learning it in the first place. So David, I have two options for you, and I'll leave links with Jack for to go in the description. One is something that somebody's making on Etsy. So it's kind of a homemade, but they've figured out the process. And that one is $40 and it seems pretty nice. It looks like a decent sized black bin that you can just basically start using and try out. The other option is one on Amazon that's kind of like an engineered design thing that's being built in molds, and it looks pretty nice as well. This one is $150, so one might be, I think they both, as far as function, are going to be really similar, but one is just a handmade something that somebody's selling on Etsy and seems to be, from everything I can tell, correct. And another one is a little bit more production oriented that's being sold on Amazon. So I'll send both links to Jack, and I think it's great to get started on this and try it and then go from there rather than trying to build out something and never getting to it. So I think you're absolutely on the right track there. And part of the reason I wanted to combine these two is, Will, you might consider using black soldier fly as well. If you're raising a lot of rabbits, but let's say you also have chickens, you could have their manure processed through this system. And if you're killing rabbits, you're going to have guts and things for your own that come from your own processing that you could use black soldier flies as well. One note is that you're going to have the same issue as you would with worms and vermicomposting as you do with black soldier flies, and that's that the rabbit poop is going to be too strong in and of itself, and it's also going to break down into like a thick matted layer for the black soldier flies. So you're going to have to mix other things in there. But I'd consider that as another possible angle at this, as I'm questioning whether or not the worms will actually bring you a profit when you accurately account for your time and the materials to build these things out. So I hope that answers both of your questions. If you have more as far as those questions are concerned, feel free to reach out to me. And everybody else, till next time, go get your hands dirty.
Great stuff from Ryan, as always. And I really encourage you to make sure that you have some form of biological composting on your property. Not, I guess all composting is biological, but maybe biointensive. Like when we use worms or BSL, and I really like to stack BSL output into worm bins and go through a dual process there. The microorganism colony that you build up in that is extensive. And in bioreactors, one thing I want to point out about bioreactors, when they're done right, they're actually a form of giant vermicomposting. That's what they really are. I've never, especially since I've figured out how to keep the fire ants the hell out of my bioreactors, I have never opened up a bioreactor that wasn't just full of worms. So it's just, the person wrote in and said they wanted a slower or faster method, because bioreactor composting does take about a year to do correctly, but you can run all of these simultaneously. Anyway, good stuff. And I tried to put our stuff that was like homesteading centric together today, back to back. So now Carrie Brown, who was with us just yesterday talking about designing your homestead so you own it instead of it owning you, he's going to talk to you a little bit today about grazing sheep to improve pasture on the homestead in these smaller groups. Like, he's got about 40 sheep. You could have four, you could have 40. I think anything south of about 50 is a relatively small herd. And you're just people running thousands like Greg Judy. And that's what's great about these animals. They're small. They're easier to manage than cattle. They can get by on pasture that cattle would have a hard time doing. They're easier to deal with. You're less likely to be injured by them. Everybody I know that runs cattle, they describe cattle as stupid and dangerous, It's not that they're malicious. They're just stupid and big, and therefore they're dangerous. Sheep are kind of stupid, but they're nowhere near as big. Anyway, they're a great way to improve pasture. That's what this is going to mostly center on. So let me turn it over to Kerry.
Hey, TSP community. Kerry here from Strong Roots Resources. And I wanted to let you guys know, I'm going to make a small shift to the content I'm providing for the expert council. I ran this past Jack, and he was fully on board. You guys know me as the plant guy, and that's true, and I love foraging, and I'm incredibly passionate about it. But the other thing that I have really been digging my heels into for a few years now is pasture improvement, rotational grazing, in my case, with these 40-something Katahdin hair sheep that I've got. Especially from the perspective of the small homestead and dealing with suboptimal lands and conditions, fallow lands, invasive species, all of that sort of thing. So I'm going to start bringing you guys some content related to that, but I'm also 100% open to your questions about all things sheep care, rotational grazing, all these management strategies, specifics on poisonous plants, potentially poisonous plants, all sorts of how they, let me figure out how I want to say this, how they choose what to eat, kind of the thinking, the brain work behind all of these aspects. I've been to a number of conferences on this lately, really been deep diving it, and of course experimenting and adjusting here on our own farm. So I feel like I have a lot to bring you guys, especially within kind of the beginner to intermediate window of all this. So that's my goal. So send things through the Jack like usual if you have anything about rotational grazing that I can help you with. So what I wanted to open with on this part, though, is why a lot of small homesteads can struggle with grazing. And I have seen this. I have seen this in multiple places on both, places I have visited. People have had me out to try to tighten up their management. And then, of course, I see it all the time in passing as I'm driving around our region here. When you drive past a pasture any time of year and all you see are a few kind of clumps of things sticking up and everything else basically looks like a golf course that has been pitted and tracked over, that is a case of continuous grazing, which is certainly less than ideal. And places that look like that, those animals are probably being supplemented with hay and grain and other feeds throughout most of the year. So over time, we're going to get into why we want to avoid this, for your budget, for your time, for the health of your animals, for the quality of the product that you're trying to grow out. So because I see this, so frequently, it's concerning, especially from the permaculture perspective, because that means that we're not getting water infiltration. We're getting a lot of erosion, like we've discussed before, how so much soil is exported into our creeks and then our rivers and then eventually to the Mississippi and the Gulf of Mexico. So when that pasture is not improving and those animals aren't thriving like they could be, it can be really frustrating. A lot of us will see this, we'll recognize it's happening, but we don't really know how to manage it. So I'm going to suggest kind of a flip on the perspective here, because this is something I've seen this. I've experienced this myself, and so that's why I've been making all these adjustments. Even when you're moving animals and things aren't getting better, here's what we're going to go look for and try to sort out. Rotational grazing, it's not really about just moving animals. It's about how long the pasture gets to recover after they leave and before they return. That's what you're looking for. You can move animals all the time. You can move them fast. You can stock them densely. You can stock them over a wider area. But if they come back too soon, or if you graze it too hard the first time, especially at certain times of year, you're really just beating your pasture down. And of course, on a small property, that shows up quickly. You don't have a lot of extra acreage to hide your boo-boos. So one of the early traps in the thinking that we need to address is, looking out into your field and saying, yeah, there's still grass out there. They're good to go. But what you'll start to notice over time is that they keep coming back to the same plants, their preferred plants. And those plants just keep getting weaker and weaker, and it stunts their root growth and their ability to take up nutrient, and it stunts everything above ground. It stunts their little leaf solar panels so they cannot gather that sunlight to grow. So one of the things I like to do is when I put the animals into a new paddock, I don't walk away. I get in there with them. I hang out for a little bit, try to be kind of, you know, still and calm as they kind of disperse, and I see what they go eat first. And a lot of the times, it depends on the time of year, but like in the early spring, it's, of course, the answer in early spring is everything, because they've been on hay, they're sick of it, and they will eat fescue and grasses that a lot of times they are less enthusiastic about later on when the weather gets hot. If it's green this time of year, they'll eat it. So, you know, if you're just thinking that you're moving, even if you're moving every couple of days, if you have too many animals in too large of a space, and I know this seems counterintuitive, but I'll explain it. Too many animals in too large of a space means that those animals aren't having to compete with one another. So you may have heard of mob grazing or intensive grazing and, you know, increased stocking density. That means that your animals are in a smaller space and they have to compete with one another. So they may choose to eat something that is less palatable to them. And you get a more even and less selective grazing. Highly selective grazing is actually not ideal. We can get into some stuff about poisonous plants. I think I'll save that for another segment exclusively, but we do want to be sure we are not leaving them in the space for so long that they are forced to eat things that are not good for them, especially in large quantities. So instead of asking, where should I move them next, you need to start asking, when will this paddock actually be ready again? And that one question is what changes everything. Because now you're looking at the regrowth of everything in there, the plant height, how fast things are bouncing back, and you're not just trying to find a schedule on the calendar. The calendar is largely irrelevant here. The time of year and the response of all these plants are what matters. So what I recommend for a lot of small setups is to keep your paddocks smaller than it feels comfortable at first. If it is large enough that they can wander back and bite off fresh growth from 2 or 3 days ago, they bite that plant, the plant immediately responds. If they go back, we call that back grazing. That's what is really hard on things. That's kind of hard to avoid entirely in the winter time, but when everything is in active growth, you know, spring, summer, and fall, we really want to avoid this. And we'll do another episode about rolling out hay and bale grazing and all that. So I'm going to break these strategies down by time of year. So I really want to try to get this into smaller chunks for you guys. Short graze periods are what you're looking for, and more stocking density. And then give that pasture more rest than you think it needs, especially when the growth slows down. There's kind of this thought that animals need a lot of space. That's not really true. Now, we don't want to crowd a bunch of animals into a confinement system. That's not what I'm talking about. But it's even sheep, especially sheep, actually, they have a strong flocking behavior. They want to be in a group. They want to be close to one another. You know, if you watch them, if something spooks them or if they feel pressured, they will gather up in a group. And that's not always the case for goats. So sheep are where I've really been spending my time on this. But, so you want to make use of that behavior naturally. So once all this starts clicking together for you, you're going to notice some pretty immediate changes. The pasture should start looking thicker instead of thinner when you've gone through your regrowth cycle. Animals will spend less time hunting for the good stuff, the dessert, as Joel Salatin puts it, because it's more evenly available. And you're not trying to constantly fix problems with feed, inputs, extra work, and that sort of thing. So if there's one thing I'd like to pass along at this point, it's don't focus on the movement. Focus on the recovery. And if you get that part right, a lot of the other pieces will start to fall into place. So that's what I've got for you guys right now. Let me know how I can help you guys on this. I'm working out kind of a bit of a seasonal flow chart. I think I'm going to even be able to do some monthly grazing reports from my own place where I'll be talking about how we've been moving, how the pasture is looking, and all those sort of fine details. So thanks for listening. Carrie at Strong Roots Resources, strongrootsresources@gmail.com if you want to send anything my way, and we will talk to you guys next time.
Great stuff from Ryan, as always. And I really encourage you to make sure that you have some form of biological composting on your property. Not, and I guess all composting is biological, but maybe biointensive. Like when we use worms or BSL, and I really like to stack BSL output into worm bins and go through a dual process there. The microorganism colony that you build up in that is extensive. And in bioreactors, one thing I want to point out about bioreactors, when they're done right, they're actually a form of giant vermicomposting. That's what they really are. I've never, especially since I've figured out how to keep the fire ants the hell out of my bioreactors, I have never opened up a bioreactor that wasn't just full of worms. So it's just the person wrote in and said they wanted a slower or faster method because bioreactor composting does take about a year to do correctly. But you can run all of these simultaneously. Anyway, good stuff. And I tried to put our stuff that was like homesteading centric together today, back to back. So now Carrie Brown, who was with us just yesterday talking about designing your homestead so you own it instead of it owning you, he's going to talk to you a little bit today about grazing sheep to improve pasture on the homestead in these smaller groups. Like he's got about 40 sheep. You could have four. You could have 40. I think anything south of about 50 is a relatively small herd. And you're just people running thousands like Greg Judy. And that's what's great about these animals. They're small. They're easier to manage than cattle. They can get by on pasture that cattle would have a hard time doing. They're easier to deal with. You're less likely to be injured by them. Everybody I know that runs cattle, they describe cattle as stupid and dangerous. It's not that they're malicious. They're just stupid and big, and therefore they're dangerous. Where sheep are kind of stupid, but they're nowhere near as big. Anyway, they're a great way to improve pasture. That's what this is going to mostly center on. So let me turn it over to Carrie.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today's question comes from Sarah. Sarah saw some alarming headlines about Sweden's national ID system getting hacked and personal data being sold on the dark web. She wants to know, is this something Americans should be worried about? And what can we do to protect ourselves? Sarah, this is a great question. You don't need to panic about Sweden's specific breach, but you should be paying attention to what this event and other recent news here in the United States reveals about where things are heading. Let me explain what happened, then give you the bigger picture, what really matters. Sweden uses a digital identity system called BankID. It's their primary electronic ID, used daily by millions of people to access government portals, banks, make payments, and sign documents digitally. Think of it as a simple login for everything digital. This is not optional. It's required to renew a prescription, file taxes, log into a bank account. For most services, there's no paper fallback. It's BankID or nothing. In mid-March, a hacker group breached an IT contractor supporting BankID infrastructure. The contractor, CGI, confirmed the incident. Hackers posted a large data set and allegedly offered to sell personal information from the hack. CGI claims the breach was just internal test servers, not production data. Regardless of the success of this particular hack, it's still alarming. This is not an isolated event. Sweden has had issues before. In July 2025, Cyber News researchers found an unsecured database sitting wide open on the public internet, requiring no password at all. It contained over 100 million records on Swedish citizens with full legal names, personal identity numbers, tax filings, debt records, bankruptcy histories, and more. Ransomware attacks on Swedish municipality service provider Miljödata and their grid operator exposed even more personal data. It gets worse. Last year, BankID was unavailable for several hours after a targeted denial of service attack. Sweden has just over 10 million people, over 8.6 million users were unable to send or receive money or log into their bank accounts or anything requiring bank ID because the single pipe everything ran through went down. With everything depending on one system, an outage can become a national emergency. In the United States, we have our own issues. In February of 2026, a hacker group breached LexisNexis, one of the largest legal and data research companies in the world. They serve 85% of the Fortune 500 and over 7,500 government agencies. They hold a critical position for legal research, identity verification, and financial compliance. LexisNexis claims this compromised data was old legacy data with no social security numbers or driver license numbers included. But an earlier breach in 2025 did expose social security numbers, and this one included a large number of database tables, millions of records compromised, which did include real names, phone numbers, and job functions. The hackers exploited an unpatched vulnerability that had been flagged to patch immediately, but wasn't updated for over 2 months. Now, for everyone in the United States, even though you may never have subscribed to LexisNexis and may never have even heard of them before, your data is probably in their system. They gather data from over 10,000 different sources, including public and private records, local tax and property records, insurance information, and federal court documents. If you've bought a house, registered a car, filed in a court, set up a utility account, or gotten a loan, there's a good chance your information is in there. The examples in Sweden and with LexisNexis may look different, but they aren't. In both cases, enormous amounts of sensitive information were aggregated together into centralized systems. In both cases, a failure in one organization exposed large amounts of information. And these are just recent high-profile examples. There are many other governments and organizations with large data sets that are attractive targets. To be fair, these centralized systems do make some things more convenient, but at what cost? And who bears that cost? And most importantly, do you have the ability to opt out, or are you forced to participate? If you have multiple bank accounts and something goes wrong with one, you can still access the others on their own systems. The concern here is that systems that deal with your identity can impact everything in your life, so the damage could be much larger. A population that authenticates through a single system could be locked out of that system, either individuals being persecuted or attacks on the entire country. All that access and information available in one location. It is a very tempting target. And Sweden is not alone. Under EU regulation, every member state must make at least one digital identity wallet available to citizens by the end of 2026. In the United States, more than three quarters of citizens already live in states where mobile driver's licenses are active or in development. The TSA is accepting digital IDs at the airport checkpoints. The future is here. You can't opt out of every system, but there are things that you can do. First, just being aware can help you. Reduce your data footprint when you can. The less personal data sitting in systems you don't control, the less you lose when those systems get breached. Think carefully before handing your information to any service that doesn't genuinely need it. And where you have alternatives, including self-hosted ones, consider using them. Running services on a home server like StartOS keeps your data in a place only you can control. Every service you don't sign up for is data that can't be stolen from someone else's system. Next, consider opting out of public databases. For LexisNexis, the site is optout.lexisnexis.com. For the big U.S. credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion, and Innovis, they offer optoutprescreen.com to avoid them sharing your data to folks for pre-approved credit cards and similar offers. Other large data gatherers generally also allow some opt-out. These moves don't stop organizations from gathering data on you, but it can help reduce how much gets shared around. Definitely use strong, unique passwords and a password manager, preferably self-hosted. Two-factor authentication for important accounts is good too. This won't protect you from a breach at the company holding your data, but it can limit what an attacker can do with what they stole. Watch out for phishing schemes and possible scams that ask for your information. In general, don't provide your information unless you are initiating the request. If someone calls, texts, or emails asking you to verify your identity, don't just click on their website link. Call back through a number you looked up yourself or go to their official website. Finally, pay attention to possible changes proposed in state and federal laws and rules. Personally, I follow the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org, to stay informed on what's happening for privacy issues. To sum it all up, the bigger the target, the more incentive bad people have to attack it. Sweden did not get hacked because they were careless. They got hacked because they were valuable. LexisNexis is the same. They were hacked because of all the sensitive data on hundreds of millions of Americans and their large global content collection. This is not a bug that can be fixed in these systems. This is the design, the reality of these large centralized systems. They're a big target, and always will be. For those that remember Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid, remember, best block, no be there. This is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Sarah, thank you for your question. Please keep the questions coming in to Jack. This is exactly the kind of topic our community needs to be thinking about.
You know, what I'll add to that is this is part of why I love having Start 9 as a sponsor. And they can do a lot of things for you when it comes to data, because by housing your own data and being able to access it from anywhere in the world and protecting your privacy in other ways, having a Start 9 server can do a lot for you. But it doesn't really fix the issue that the person was asking about, or the issue that Jesse was hitting on there, which is there are certain things that we are now being forced into centralized databases for, and that is going to be attacked because it is a honeypot, because it is valuable, because it is worth doing. If I am able to hack into Kerry Brown or Ryan Stiva's information, I might be able to gain something from that. But if I can get into a database with the information of a couple thousand or a couple hundred thousand or a couple million or a couple hundred million people, now I really got something. And now I can like take it apart and data rake it and figure out who to attack for what and what to use where and what to just sell. And this is not a new problem either, and it's not always about a centralized database being hacked. Sometimes it's about incompetent behavior where we give people in government too much power. Here's an example. Nothing ever came of this that I know of. And maybe whoever ended up with this computer just got rid of it, threw it away, wiped it clean, and used it or hawked it or whatever. But back about the time I started the show, only a few years into it, I got a letter in the mail, yep, from the military. Never like to say that together, because that was a cadence, right? Got a letter in the mail. Anyway, this letter was a different kind of letter. It said, "Dear Veteran, there was this breach of information," and they didn't exactly spell out exactly what happened in the letter, but you and 60,000 other veterans may need to keep an eye on your privacy because your data, including your social security number, was potentially obtained by people you don't want to have it. I'm paraphrasing here. Well, what actually happened was there was a employee that was a member of the Department of Veterans Affairs. For some freaking reason, had a huge chunk of the database of all veterans on their laptop. And they went somewhere, and then they left the laptop wherever they went, and when they went back to get it, it was gone, and it was never recovered, ever. And so that's the human flaw. And most hacks, even when they get into a place, they generally rely on some level of social engineering, i.e. phishing, P-H-I-S-H, phishing. Like, you get these emails, "I'm a Nigerian prince, and I have money for you," or God knows what else. "Hey, you just had your PayPal account charged for $620. I got one of these 5 minutes ago while I'm listening to this. You got a $627 charge on your PayPal. If you didn't make this charge, call this number and we'll reverse the charge for you." And then you call that number. I call it to mess with them, and they say, "Hello, PayPal." And then you say something like, "Really? PayPal never answers the phone that way. They have an automated intake system. Maybe you guys need to get better at your scam," and you waste their time and try to save somebody else from getting scammed. But, you know, that's the kind of engineering. But this gets done in a lot of ways, and you can never control the security practices or the people who work for these places that have these huge databases. And that means we always need to be on guard for what could potentially happen if somebody gets our information. And it's why services, you know, where, you know, you have things like LifeLock that makes it very difficult for somebody to take out credit in your name, or title lock, which makes it all but impossible for people to gain access to the title of your home, your mortgage, your equity. And because that's one of the bigger problems that happens kind of more instead of these central databases on a one-off, is there are people that will figure out how to claim that they are the owner of your real property, and then they will take out like home equity loans against it. They'll get as much money as they can. They don't care what the terms are. And there's people that have lost their homes because it turned out they were completely underwater with their house leverage. So it's worth making sure that you pay attention to things like this and have some means of either guarding it or at least checking on it on a regular basis. And again, when you can avoid centralization, you might want to do so. Moving on from here, we're going to now talk about nursery crops with Nick Ferguson. What is a nursery crop? Is that like stuff that you grow and then you go and you buy it at a nursery where you get like six packs of plants? No, it's a different thing. And I'll turn it over to Nick.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with a question from Melanie on the show I did with Jack back in the beginning of March. And she writes, question, Nick, you mentioned a nursery crop in the 3426 episode with Jack. Could you expand on this concept? Thanks, Melanie. Well, Melanie, what I meant by that was a crop of trees, shrubs, forbs, ground covers, like a typical food forest guild. You know, imagine all those different layers. I typically don't like to add vines in there because they can get really messy. But things like trees and shrubs and iron and clay, cowpea, things that are going to put nutrients into the soil, start feeding soil microbes, all hardy species that are going to take the brunt of a new and immature ecosystem establishment. Think of them like the brave soldiers that stormed the beaches of Normandy. They're going to take tons of hits, there's going to be losses, there's going to be death, like what happened on D-Day. So if we're going to be taking some land back from the enemy, making it beautiful and useful, something more like a garden than a wasteland, it's going to take some effort. It's going to take some danger, some risk. We can invest in that system with truckloads of mulch, manure, expensive minerals, earthworm castings, irrigation equipment, shade structures like pergolas, and have a nearly instant Edenic paradise, but it's going to cost a lot of money and effort to do that. Or if you're on a little bit more of a longer time frame, lower dollar investment and lower effort investment, you could send in some troops to take the brunt of the environmental trouble that's going to be in a harsher, more brittle environment. And you can let them do the work for us with a few years of time invested in the system, and we can plant support species like I have in the support species pack. We plant those out, we start propagating them even the first year. We fertilize them, we do some chop and drop mulching with those plants that are growing. We spend far less money on those hardy species, get them growing, use them as the mulch, the soil building tools, the mineral miners. They're literally going to send out roots really deep and find minerals, bring them up into their branches and leaves, and if you're chopping and dropping them or making compost out of them, or biochar, or Johnson Sioux beam compost, and you're adding that to that ecosystem, what you're going to end up with is all of those trees and shrubs are going to be making things like shade structures and soil, and they're going to get established, and they're going to help bring life into the soil. And then, you know, a little bit of time, you know, a couple years down the road, they're 6 to 8 feet tall, the system is more mature. Then you drop in the expensive $50 berry bush or the $75 fruit tree. You can drop $5,000 in all the expensive trees, shrubs, vines, and strawberry plants, for instance, into the system with a lot more confidence because we've tamed, we've controlled the area with the support species. We have some good soil built up. There's moisture holding capacity in the soil from the glomalin, from the fungal species that are doing work in there, from all the activity of these support species that we started out with. We don't have to do as much work with truckloads of mulch, for instance, because these support species are doing the work for us. That's the whole idea with these guilds. I cannot tell you in all the over a decade that I've been doing this professionally, how many people I've spoken to who have year after year, before they hired me to come out and help them with their property, they've spent $250 to $1,000 a year, multiple years in a row, trying to establish a little fruit orchard or berry patch, buying vines and trees and bushes, only to have them, the majority of them, die year after year. It's all because they didn't have the system set up for those expensive fruits at the start. It's like buying two dozen chickens. That's like $720, like $30 a piece, if I'm doing my math right. And not having a pen to protect them. Not having a coop to keep them protected at night. What's going to happen? Foxes, coons, possums, they're going to wipe them all out over the course of a week. Your $720 is going to go up in smoke, all because you didn't have the infrastructure there to protect the investment from the get-go. And that's what that nursery crop is. It's protection for your investment. Great question, Melanie. Thanks for that. And for anybody listening, I'm going to be starting scheduling my next short consulting tour towards the East Coast, South, you know, Deep South, in the next month or so. So if you want someone like me to help you craft a game plan, get a really good design for your property, and avoid costly mistakes like I just talked about, I'm going to be hitting states like Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, both of the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, all of those states, and maybe a couple around there. So if you want to get on one of those tours, send me an email with consulting in the subject line to Nick, N-I-C-K, at homegrownliberty.com. Do good things.
Yeah, you know, kind of another way to look at it is like this. If you look out and you see a giant empty field, and it's beginning to grow in and nobody mows it, and you leave it alone long enough, as long as it's in an ecosystem conducive for it, eventually it's going to turn into kind of a tangled woody mess and like a woodlot, and then like eventually a full-on forest. But you know what doesn't happen? You don't like walk out in the middle of that field like, you know, let's say a couple of years into the process and find a whole bunch of, you know, the trees that were going to eventually be overstory oak, like a chestnut oak or a white oak or Schumann oaks or something like that, or hickories or any of the big, massive, overstory, long-term, you know, trees that live centuries a few years into it. No, you find trees like hackberry, mulberry, a lot of the trees that we use as pioneers, locusts, etc. And these are the fast-growing pioneer species, and a nursery crop is basically a crop that you built, you know, you build out yourself with intent to create that fast-growing pioneer ecosystem so you can expand it. That's kind of the short version of what Nick just said for you there. Let's move on. I got one more before I give you my segment. And don't let the term turn you off. You're going to like this one. Boiled meat with Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. This week's question comes from John. John, good hearing from you. He wants the best procedure for cooking a corned beef or traditional boiled dinner. Damn, John, when you ask it like that, it sounds so good. Boiled meat. And before you check out, stick with me here. Because most people hear boiled meat and they immediately turn to something that's like gray and overcooked and just disappointing, to be honest. But that's not the method. And that's really just bad cooking when you're doing something like that. Boiled meat isn't really boiled meat. It's a controlled simmer. And that's where people go wrong, right? Done right, boiled meat is honestly one of the most useful ways to cook tougher cuts of beef. And if you're buying half a cow or you got a pig or something, and this is how you start unlocking what's actually in your freezer. So let's start making this practical, right? We're going to focus on a leaner cut today, so minimal fat. So think brisket, fat trimmed, the flat portion, right? Bring your pot of water up to a boil and just throw it in, go outside and mow the yard. For the love of God, do not do this, right? Let's do this right? So you're going to take a pot, make sure that the it's big enough for the piece of meat that you're going to put it in. You put the meat in and you cover it with cold water. This is very important. If you want all of the little impurities and things to come to the surface that makes the liquid much, much better, start with cold water. So you're going to bring it up slowly. And as it heats, you're going to see this foam rise to the top. It's nasty, but it's normal, okay? You're going to skim it. This is one of those small steps that makes a big difference in the final product. After it's been kind of coming up and you've skimmed off almost everything, there's not really much left, you need to season the liquid. And I mean actually season it. Salt, onion, garlic, bay leaf, peppercorns, whatever. Okay? Now, if you're going to be going, we're going to be talking about corned beef in a second. So if you're using a salt-cured meat, I'd go easy on the salt because you're already going to be introducing something that has a little bit of salt in it. But more to that in a little bit later. But if you've got carrots and celery, throw them in, right? Now, here's where everything works or it falls apart. Turn down the heat. You're not boiling. You are barely simmering. A few bubbles. It's like that moment when you're watching a pot ready to boil and you're still wondering if it's boiling, but it's actually not. That's that perfect time right there. It's not bubbling. It's just kind of like barely rippling, and it's like a good simmer. If it looks aggressive, you've gone way too far. Because if you boil too hard, that meat tightens up and it pushes moisture out of that muscle. You end up with something dry. Even though it's sitting in water, that meat will be very, very dry. And if you go too long of cooking in a boiling or hot simmer situation, there's a window where everything is perfect, tender and structured and just delicious. But you push past that even a little bit, then it turns soft and grainy. And it just, that's when all the things that boiled meat comes to mind. It's just disgusting. This is why even in a crock pot, your roast, even chuck roast, come out dry and grainy. You're just cooking it too long. There are points where you just can go, simmering doesn't no longer matter. Cooking slowly no longer matters. You're now just cooking a very tough, grainy piece of meat. So this is all about control. So let's talk about what he asked about, corned beef. So corned beef is just brisket that's been cured in salt. That's it. And here's a little fun fact. The word corned doesn't refer to corn at all. It comes from an old term for these large grains of salt called corns. So corned beef literally means salt cured beef. So before you cook it, key tip, you need to rinse it. Even if you're buying it from the store, even if you did it yourself, rinse it again. A quick rinse under cold water will remove any excessive surf salt, and it helps a lot. Then you get to the pot, cold water, bring it up, skim that foam. Go easy on adding more salt because it's already seasoned. And I say this twice now, even three times, because you will try it and that salt will start permeating very quickly and you'll go from, this is delicious to, holy crap, this is way too salty. So you're going to simmer for about 2.5 to 3 hours depending on the size. And again, keep that heat under control. So here's where you've got options. You can go traditional. Throw cabbage, potatoes, carrots in the same pot, boil till tender, pull everything out, let it cool, slice it. Delicious. Or you can pull the meat now, let it rest, and then you focus back on the pot and reduce that broth down to about a cup to a half a cup. You're making this very intensely rich jus that is going to be beautiful with your corned beef. So that's usually my move when I do corned beef. I like the cabbage and potatoes, and I'll do that as well, but then I'll render down that liquid way down till it gets so intensely flavorful, and that's where if you have too much salt in there, you've basically wasted all that jus. Okay? So let's go a little further. Crazy. Now, for some of you, this is easy, and this is delicious, and some of you, we've gone a step too far. Beef tongue. This is where people hesitate. But it's one of the best textures of the animal if you treat it right. Same process. Cold water. Bring it up. Skim. Now, if you're getting the tongue straight from your property, you just butchered like I do, you dang sure I'm going to be washing that thing 10 times, if not more. Now, if it's from the store, you can usually guess that it's probably going to be clean, but I would never trust always wash your tongue because you never know what was in that cow's mouth before you got there. Okay? Cold water. Bring it up. Skim. Salt, aromatics, then give it time. This time, maybe 3 to 4 hours, if not more. Okay? You're not going to want to rush this one. But when it's done, you pull it out while it's still hot, and it's going to be hot, using towels and tongs and ways to protect yourself. If you've got gloves, now's a good time to use it. But you peel the outer membrane of that tongue, and it should come off very easily. Boiled meats could be a longer discussion, but these are just the core principles of it, right? Honestly, a sous vide is a great choice, but it's not always an option. So learning to cook in one of the most basic and oldest techniques is probably one of the biggest survival techniques that you can learn. Boiled a pot of water on a fire is readily available, and a sous vide is not in emergency situations. But you can still cook incredibly well. Just know how to do it. So, as always, if you need more information, check me out at bloodsugarchef.com. John, I hope this helps with everything. If not, reach out to me on Telegram, because John is very big on Telegram, and I always love talking to him there. But until next time, this is Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
I'll just add in, this is why I always cringe when I see things online where people are like, here's a quick one-pot meal. And it's like, I'm leaving the house at 7 o'clock in the morning to go to work. And you just throw all the shit in the crock pot and put it on low, and you get home at 6:30. And not only have you overdone even the meat, usually in that situation, there's ways that will work, okay? But you know, like if you like do everything at once, like the potatoes, the carrots, if you're doing something like that, the potatoes are just gone, even if the meat's okay. The advice you got from Ken is spot on. I'll add something else too about cooking meats, in this way, and additionally soups and stews, anything where we're using water, simmering, etc. If you go back and look at the rations that were given to military in the very early days, so I'm talking like the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, or you look at the both sides during the War Between the States, a.k.a. the American Civil War, from that whole period of time and prior to it, there were large amounts of rations, when available anyway, given out to the troops, and it'd be something like a pound of bread and a pound of meat a day per man. That would be a typical ration at the time. And this would range from salted pork, salted beef, sometimes fresh if it could be acquired where they were at the time, but about a pound of meat per man per day was the goal, plus a pound of bread. And the military absolutely hated the concept of the soldiers roasting meat. They really encouraged making soups and stews. And the reason was because things like bone, gristle, etc., and other things that could be maybe gleaned from the land, like vegetables and herbs, could all be added to that. And a lot of what would be wasted if, let's say, the person's pound of meat included some bone or something, would be extracted into the broth and probably be consumed with the bread, which was often hardtack and needed something to soften it anyway. What I'm saying, though, is they didn't have the biological medical understanding today of things like bone broth and things like the way that we actually get better extraction of like certain vegetables, nutrient, when making something like this. But they knew that it worked. And that's just maybe a little extra history lesson added on to what you heard from Ken. And it is one of the more fantastic ways to cook a lot of different things, especially those tough and less appreciated cuts, which is important more now than ever as we live in a time where everything keeps getting more expensive. All right, moving on. Let's get into what I have for you guys today. And I'm going to just read the question sent to me, and I'm going to give you a rather short answer for me anyway. I like the way this question was introduced to me. TSPC, question for Jack. Follow the rules, right? Pattern recognition, question for Jack. Is there more Agents of Chaos in the world than there's ever been? If so, it doesn't seem coincidental. I'm not just talking about devaluing the currency or the economy or having issues from gas prices. And maybe it's just me selfishly looking at the world through my own lens. But it seems to me that you can't ignore local politics any longer. You have to pay attention to who is in random positions like the insurance commissioner no one cared about. Private equity firms are buying up and destroying just about every company that makes a community function, and so on. It's almost like there's more money in chaos than in order, and to my knowledge, it's always been the other way. And chaos is where things tend to go wrong for the elites. Just pondering and thought you'd find it an interesting and relevant topic for your show. Sent from my iPhone. Regards, Justin. Well, Justin, let me see what I can do with this. I want to split this in half. I want to split it into the half where it's exactly what you think it is, and I want to split it into the half where it's not. The half where it's not first, because it's really easy to understand. It is not so much that there's more agency of chaos out there. It's that there's more visibility of what's going on. So it used to be when that insurance commissioner you talked about, or the railroad commissioner, or somebody, the dog catcher, whatever, somebody with some political power pulled some bullshit, until it actually affected somebody, you didn't know. Right? And when you found out there was a problem, you didn't even know who the instigating guy that started, because eventually other people had to like say, yeah, we're going to do this. So then it became a larger group that got the blame, right? So now you live in a world where there is somebody doing what you said, which is staying on top of all of it. And I think the only way for this really to work, maybe this is where we need more community than we do, so we can have a compound that we can all run away to and fight the blue helmets or whatever, right? Is that it would be a great idea for people that are concerned about what's going on in their local politics to form a virtual community. You don't all have to get together, but everybody gets one or two things to keep an eye on. And as long as they keep an eye on it, they kind of keep that role in the group. And if they decide they don't want to, they should tell the group so they can find somebody else to do it. And so one person might keep an eye on things like zoning and land permits, and you know, making sure boilerplate stuff's not being adopted. Like that's your one thing. Because the whole point of this agent of chaos, I like the way you put it, is that one person can't keep it all under wraps. Like you can't, like one person can't just, like, think about when you go vote, right? If you're a voter and you go vote, and think about the local people that you vote for. You have no idea who they are. And that's why so many people are like straight Republican, straight Democrat, right? Like and that's a bad thing for society, by the way. And I think part of the problem is that we have too many of these people now. There's too many people with power. Why are we electing so many people? Why does anybody have that power? Is how people like you and I might come at this, right? But they're there and they exist, and we can't just make them go away. It takes a lot of effort to say, do we really need people doing this? Because that whole government is bloated around that one elected official, probably accounts for like another 30, 40, 50, even in small communities, bureaucrats. And if you get rid of that elected official, then that need, you're saying, we don't need somebody doing this in our town, our city, or county, because we're at local here, is the way the question came in. And so then all the people that do that job got to go too. Yeah. So there is that just concept that can be proactive actually working against you. There is somebody watching all this. And then there's people using technology to monitor this that don't really care about the community. They just want attention. So if they can say, look what this Democrat did in bumfuck Ohio, right? Like, oh my God. And then the same party is probably part of like a bot farm. And look what this Republican did in bumfuck Virginia. Like, it doesn't matter what the party or the location is. So that's being broadcast, and then it gets amplified. And when it gets any traction, then it gets amplified even more. Not only do more influencers, if that's the right word for it, and secondary news sources and all pick it up, but as it gains traction, the algorithms where it's shared on social media pick it up, and they keep presenting it more and more and more. So creator A breaks the story, B, C, and D take connotations on the story, and then all of them get, and then it seems like it's everywhere. That's the illusionary part of it. It's not that it's not there, it's that it was always there and you didn't see it. Then there's the other side of it. But I don't think maybe you're grasping why it's happening. But you danced on it so close when you said, it seems like there's more money in chaos than in order, and I don't think this is the way it's usually been. There's always money in disruption and chaos to a degree, but when it becomes the de facto standard to cause chaos, And if you think about the chaos politically and economically, it is global, national, state, regional, county, city, town. It is everywhere. Do you know what it really signifies? It signifies a society or a dominant empire or a dominant small group of empires, i.e. one or two or three empires controlling everything globally. And this is kind of the first time in history that's really, really possible. Because even like during the heyday of like the British Empire, you know, they would say the sun never sets or whatever. Any place that wasn't really somebody else's empire. You know, I mean, yeah, the Dutch had some colonies and stuff, but I mean, it wasn't like it is today. Like the chaos now has greater ability to spread because of technology. We can communicate, you know, to every corner of the world at the speed of light. And that's been the case since really the telecommunication age became possible. Like it started out with telegraph under oceans and stuff, but you know, by the time there were like commercials like reach out and touch someone, you can hear a pin drop, if you remember those. Like we had global businesses as a de facto standard, so we had global governance, at least global competition for governance as a de facto standard. And so you have the real side of it as well. The question is, what are you going to do about it? And to answer that question, you should ask, but what does it mean? And I think what it means is the end of empire. I think the U.S. empire is falling apart. It's unraveling. And I don't say that with a great deal of sorrow, but I do say it with some trepidation. I don't think we need to be the global police force. I don't want us to be the global police force. I would say the most disappointing thing about Trump, not necessarily to me because I had no expectations, but to the people that expected great things, was that we would stop doing all this world policing bullshit. And like, so some of his biggest, like, it's all TDS or whatever. No, some of the guy's biggest supporters right now, like, what are we even doing? Chaos. Even if it's not chaos, it's how it feels. The communication is dumb. The war's over. We're going to bomb the shit out of them for 3 more weeks. Wait a minute. In one sentence? Really? And so does that mean that Trump's just so stupid, or does it mean Trump is playing to the times? And I don't mean the paper. I mean the times that we live in. I think it's a mix of all of these things. And I think that when you have the end of a dominance period, right, where there was a certain dominant method by which control was enacted, not just empire, but dominance of control, the mechanisms of control and dominance in the world are falling apart. Some of the things that they brought in to better control you are being used better by you for freedom than them to control you. That would be the internet. Here you are listening to somebody as out of the box as me, and some of you guys have been listening to me since almost day one. 2 decades, a guy like me has had influence in the world. Where the hell could that happen without the internet? Because no internet, no podcast. Well, I mean, what was my options to do something like this 30 years ago? Now, I don't mean being a coffee schlepping intern and getting into radio, because I could never do this on radio. There was never a time that this could be done on radio, at least legally, publicly, above board. About the only way you could run something like I'm doing today would have been one like the underground newsletters, where you actually sent physical newsletters to people, pamphlets, or something like pirate radio, which would be inherently limited in how far it would reach. That's why, remember an old movie with Christian Slater and it was really young, Pump Up the Volume, right? Hard Harry. Like that wouldn't even be a thing today. Hard Harry would just have the Hard Harry podcast. And so you couldn't even make that movie today because nobody would get it. That's not that long ago. That was, I think, 1989. I know for some of you, like, 1989? Holy shit. Well, what do you find out when I was born, boy? If you think 1989 was a long time ago. It's not that long ago. The whole world has changed in how everybody communicates, but also that has changed the mechanism of control. What happens when there's a power vacuum is a fight for power. That's what you're really seeing, a fight for power. And a lot of it we can do some things about, especially at the local level. I just had a conversation with Ken Berry this morning about some other things, but you know, he's very involved in Tennessee politics now. And God bless them for it, because I can't do it. That's not my thing. But I'm glad people do it. I think because I am so anti-political, sometimes people think I don't appreciate those of you who get involved. I do. A great deal. But I also think we all have our own lane that we need to stay in of where we can do the most good. And that's why I think watchdog groups need to stop being something that's like the National Association of blah, blah, blah. Because they just become subject to the iron law bureaucracy too, like anything else. I think Bill, Steve, Dan, Tom's, Alice, Tiffany, right? Like getting together and saying, you know what we're going to do? We're going to keep an eye on what happens in our city and our county. And each one of us is going to take one little area and we're just going to watch it like a hawk and we're going to tell everybody when it happens and then we're all going to reach out to all our friends and make a shitstorm about it when they do something we don't like. And at times you're going to push a string because you think, boy, people are really going to respond, and they're not. They're not going to care. But if that's your thing, then you should do that. But I do think it's a split. Part of the what we're seeing was always there. Always has been there, always will be there. We'll constantly have new permutations and new ways it comes. There's always people that want more power, more control, more authority, and more dominance, and have always been that way, but we have more visibility of it now than ever, which is both good and bad. And then there is the real acceleration of that chaos, which I think is less like, hey, mwahaha, let's get together at the Global Alliance for World Domination with Dr. Evil and figure out, how, you know, which would be, you know, George Soros, and figure out how to do it. And I think it's more a natural consequence of, with so many disruptions and so many shifts in society and so much technology extending reach, everybody's trying to fight for their piece of the pie to control it. And again, I think the best thing you can do it about it is build the most resilient and self-reliant individual life you can, like I've always taught. Because there's some things that really are inside your circle of control and your circle of influence, but a lot of this stuff really is out in your circle of concern. And when it's in your circle of concern, its only value is, can you apply influence so that you can actually drag it down into your influence? And if you can't, then it is, what does it mean for you and what do you do about it, and then move on with your life? And if the answer is, this doesn't really affect me, I'm just upset about it, let it go. Because every second you spend on it lowers your performance, lowers your advancement, lowers everything in your life. With that, I'm ready to wrap up. I appreciate you guys tuning in today. I want to remind you, if you like the show and the work that I do, one of the ways you can help support us is just by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That is T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day goes in your kitchen. I guess you can put it anywhere you want, but your kitchen's where you probably should keep it. It is an end grain wood bamboo cutting board. I have been using the one I have since 2016. That's 10 years. I'm not going to say it looks brand new, because it doesn't. It still performs like brand new, though. Bamboo is incredibly hard, incredibly tough. It is a great material to work with, and it's infinitely renewable. When you cut down a great big, giant, tall bamboo thing that's about as big around as your leg, it immediately starts to grow back. It's a grass, is what it is. It's a giant grass, but it's way harder than people realize. It is extremely hard. And that means that most of the cheapo bamboo cutting boards that you buy in a store or a knick-knack place or something like that are actually really bad on your knives. And they don't perform very well. It's almost like cutting on stone when you have long grain. And long grain means exactly what it sounds like. So you're going against the long grain. End grain is like the bristles on a good dart board. If you put your hands together like you're praying with them up like a, you know, high up, and you look down at your fingers and you see the way your fingers come together, and you kind of offset them so it almost looks like a zipper, and then all those little spaces in between there, those, when the dart gets thrown on a bristle dart board, they kind of open up and let the dart in. And that's why you can throw those darts over and over and over. And that board, it takes years to wear out a dartboard, right? A dartboard in your house, if you don't play all the time, if something like you play it once a week or something, it might last longer than you do because of that approach. When we take that same sort of form factor for a cutting board and you drag a knife blade across it, what happens is the blade, the sharp part of the blade, actually goes down into the board just a little bit and goes in between the end grains. And two things happen. One, it dulls your knife a lot slower, and it makes it a lot easier to take care of your knife. You have to sharpen it more. You can get by on just using something like a steel for a lot longer before you need to move to a stone, right? So that's good from that approach. But it's also, think about it like this. Think about when you write with a pen. And if you write with a pen on a hard surface with one sheet of paper, you write like crap. It's not a smooth experience, and therefore your handwriting looks worse, etc. So if we take three or four pieces of paper and we set it down on that same hard surface and we write, now we can write, well, at least as neatly as we're capable of. And it writes a lot smoother because the paper has given it. It's kind of the same thing when you're slicing and chopping. And by the way, 90% of the time you shouldn't be chopping, you should be slicing. In other words, the blade should make movements as it goes through things. Keep your fingers right so you don't cut yourself, by the way. And when you have an end grain board, since that knife has a place for that edge to ride, you just get so much better performance. And it's one of those things, like, you will not understand how much better it is until you experience it. This thing's on sale today for like $43 or something like that. Again, I'm going to make a confession. I'm an addict with cutting boards and serving boards. Okay? And there's a difference. The serving board does not have a knife cut on top of it. I'm talking to my wife vicariously, like telepathically, because she's gone right now. You do not take, and you don't even call it a cutting board, right? But I have cutting boards and serving boards, and I have all different cool ones. I mean, different wood types, and I just think they're awesome. I love looking at them. I have some made out that are serving that are made out of olive wood when people come over, and I make hors d'oeuvres and stuff, and I put them on it. Okay, yeah, I'm weird. But the one that I reach for when I'm cooking and I'm like slicing up a bunch of tomatoes and peppers and onion and celery to make a base, a sofrito, is this. I use it every day. And if I ever lose it, give it away, somebody steals it, I don't know how the hell you'd break it, I'd buy another one instantly. So check this thing out. Again, tspaz.com, no matter what you're buying, shop it online. But if you go by the website today and next couple days, scroll down a little bit, you'll see this. Again, end grain wood bamboo cutting board. And now you know a little bit about cutting boards and end grain versus long grain and why you always want, no matter what the material is, you always want an end grain board. What about those plastic ones? And they come in different colors and cut vegetables on this. Don't buy that shit. It's garbage. You're putting microplastics in your food and it doesn't perform worth a shit. Anyway, with that, all you got to do with this kind of a cutting board is give it a good wash at the end. Give it a little bit of mineral oil about once a month to keep it conditioned. It'll last forever, and it's no risk to your health whatsoever as long as you wash it after you use it and you don't do something like cut raw chicken on it and then cut carrot sticks before you wash it and give the carrot sticks raw to your kids. They'll probably get salmonella that way, especially if you buy your chicken from the grocery store. So I'm not saying that you could just do anything, but use common sense and you will be fine. Don't let anybody scare you into buying some plastic piece of shit because they want to sell you something. That's an agent of chaos. With that, we are wrapped up for the week. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Boy, did we have a diverse lineup today. I mean, we talked about homesteading. We talked about things with homesteading like composting. We talked about sheep. We talked about nursery crops. But we also talked about cooking. Little end piece for me there, but also Ken Daniels on basically simmering, braising meats, things like that. We also talked about protecting your identity with Jesse Markowitz. My goal with this show has always been, when I say this show, I mean these end of the week expert shows, was to always bring you kind of, the kind of diversity you just can't find in programming anywhere else. I hope that we're continuing to do that for you after all these years. If you enjoyed this week, come on back. We have a whole new lineup for you next week, and we'll do it all over again.
They said you should have a house. American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.